Throughout 2019 so far, we've devoted most of our Sunday mornings to studying Genesis, the first book of the Bible. And I've just consistently tried to emphasize that if you want the most basic knowledge, the most foundational knowledge of who God is, what he's doing in the world, and how you can have a relationship with him, Genesis is the necessary starting point. It's in Genesis that we learn that God is one. There are not many gods. We learn in Genesis 1 that God is our creator, and in Genesis 2 that he's our provider. As Genesis unfolds, we learn that God is our holy, just judge, and he, our God, is our only hope for salvation. His grace is our only hope. We also learn and have learned as we've studied Abraham in recent weeks that God faithfully loves those he saves. He is so faithful. We've learned these basic truths about our God. We've also learned from Genesis what God is doing in the world. It's where we learn that God has determined to reverse all of the effects of sin, including death and its apparent reign in the world. He has determined to reverse that through Abraham's offspring. In Genesis, we don't know exactly what that plan is going to entail in detail, but we know that all of the effects of the fall, of sin and death in this world, they're somehow going to be reversed, and blessing is going to come to people of every nation somehow through Abraham's offspring. It's Genesis that gives us that most basic foundational knowledge of what God is doing in the world. And as I've pointed out for the last several weeks as we've studied Abraham, we have seen very clearly that the only right way of relating to God, who is our rightful judge, is on the basis of faith, conviction that leads to life commitment to him. That's what faith is. It's not just optimism. It is a conviction that God is, and that God has spoken, and that God's promises can be trusted, and that he himself can be relied on, and we commit our lives to him. In other words, God does not relate to us based on our performance, our obedience, our goodness. That ship has sailed. The only way God can have a relationship with us is if we will trust him, if we will entrust our lives to him. And we have seen very powerfully in the life of Abraham, most clearly going back to the beginning of chapter 15, that God declared Abraham, who was a sinner and an idolater, he declared him to be innocent in his sight. Abraham is innocent in God's sight. How did he get that innocence? It's on the basis of Abraham's faith. That is how we relate to God. So Genesis has given us these most basic fundamentals of who God is, what he's doing in the world, and how we can have a relationship with him. What I want to do today is I want to very briefly summarize chapters 20 and 21, read the first portion of chapter 22, and teach that. The reason I'm jumping over chapters 20 and 21 so quickly is because they more or less reiterate things that we have already seen, and yet they're reiterating it in a way that highlights chapter 22. So what goes on in chapter 20 is something that already happened in chapter 12, and that is Abraham is really stupid. He tells Abimelech, which is a title for the king in the region where he goes to live, he tells Abimelech again, a different Abimelech than in chapter 12, a different region. Most of the leaders of the day, kind of like Pharaoh, you can have multiple different pharaohs. It's a title of honor or respect for any given individual. Abimelech was very similar. Abimelech, the title just means my father is king. It highlights the nepotism of the ancient world. And so there was an Abimelech in chapter 12. There's another Abimelech in chapter 20. Abraham lied to Abimelech when he moved there about his wife. He said, "She's not my wife, she's my sister." And Abraham again jeopardizes God's promise to give Abraham and Sarah a son of their own, because what Abimelech does is essentially takes Sarah into his harem. It's a disgusting scenario. We learn in verse 13 of chapter 20, you might look at it, this was not some out-of-the-ordinary deception on Abraham's part. He actually says that it has been his typical MO. Wherever he has gone, he has lied this way. Yikes! Chapter 20 teaches us something that we have seen before, that God is faithful to fulfill his plan for Abraham and for us, even when we aren't faithful to him. Abraham is a habitual liar. And God is still faithful to snatch him out of this awful predicament in which he puts himself, so that God's plan and purpose for Abraham will be fulfilled. All of us learn very basically from this chapter that first, if God's blessing is going to come on the world, it's going to come through Abraham's descendant. We learn that again. But we also learn that when we commit ourselves by faith to God, he is more faithful to us than we are to him. It's awesome. Genesis 21, then, is going to begin with God blessing Abraham and Sarah with the long-awaited son. They've waited 25 years now to have this promised son, and they miraculously have a boy whom they name Isaac, Hebrew for laughter. The reason he's named laughter is twofold. First, it's because both Abraham and Sarah laughed when God first told them that they would have a son in their old age. Secondly, it's because they lived for decades without the ability to get pregnant. And when God finally gave them a child of their own, they laughed with joy. Their lives were filled with happiness. So they name him Laughter. First part of the chapter, they have a son. Second part of chapter 21, the very heart of this chapter, starting in verse 8, there's conflict between Hagar and Sarah, and finally, Sarah insists that Abraham make Hagar leave the house, and even though she and her son nearly die of dehydration in one of the largest wildernesses in the world, God doesn't let it happen. He heard Ishmael's cries. Ishmael means God hears. God hears Ishmael's cries there in the wilderness. He leads them to a nearby well, and he says, "You are going to be blessed." He says, "You're going to be blessed because of your connection with Abraham." The chapter closes then with Abraham owning his first piece of property in the promised land. And the main point of this chapter is that God is slowly but surely fulfilling his promises to bless the world through Abraham. He finally has an offspring. Hagar, a foreigner, is being blessed because of her connection with Abraham. He finally has land. Slowly and surely, the promises are being fulfilled. And that brings us now to the climactic account of Abraham's life in chapter 22. It's astounding. Chapter 22, verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." Abraham said, "Here am I." He said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah." That's present-day Jerusalem. It's about 50 miles north of where Abraham is at the time. He says, "Take him to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." Isaac was maybe 13 or so at this time. And God's demand that Abraham sacrifice this miracle-born son must have made zero sense to Abraham. God had just told him, if you look at chapter 21, verse 12, that Abraham would have many descendants through Isaac specifically. And yet, in this test that he has no clue what God is doing, Abraham obeys. Verse 3, so Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, takes a while to get 50 miles. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering. He laid it on his son Isaac, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, my father. He said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. And so both of them continued together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there. He laid the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his thorns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in other words, this is a popular proverb, on the mount of the Lord, it'll be provided. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that's on the seashore, and your offspring will possess the gate of your enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you've obeyed my voice. It is absolutely certain, Abraham, I am verifying everything I've been promising to you for the last 25 years. It is certain. It's going to happen. In your offspring, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Verse 19 says, so Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together 50 miles back to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. What is the main point of Genesis 22, what we just read? Well, the Lord tests Abraham's faith. It's a test of faith. Abraham passes the test. And God, on that basis, reassures him of every promise he's made to this point, including the climactic promise to bless all nations through Abram's offspring. But you have to note that the test itself is significant. He tests Abraham. Abraham passes. He comes out of the test saying, I'm certainly going to do everything I've promised. But what's remarkable here is the test itself shows, it previews how God's going to bless the world through Abram's offspring. The test itself is showing how the promise is going to be fulfilled. So I'd state it like this. The main point of Genesis 22 is, through testing Abraham's faith, the Lord dramatically shows that through Abraham, he will bless the world by providing his own sacrifice on the hill in Jerusalem. This is incredible. Abraham says, when Isaac asks him, where's the sacrifice? Abraham says, God's going to provide the sacrifice, my son. On the mount is where the Lord's going to provide himself the sacrifice. And Abraham and Isaac go up there. God provides the sacrifice. Abraham calls the place, the Lord will provide. And there's a proverb that says, on the mountain, it will be provided. The main point is that through testing Abraham's faith, God actually shows how he's going to bless the world. It's through providing his own sacrifice on this hill in Jerusalem. Let's unpack it. There are three reactions you should have to Genesis 22. The first one is you need to react with horror and then think it through. If you read Genesis 22 and you respond something like this, how in the world could God ask a loving father to murder his innocent son? You wouldn't be the first to react that way, and you wouldn't be the first to struggle this way. A few years ago, Dave Conant taught this passage in a Sunday school class that I was in, and he introduced us in that Sunday school class to one of the most famous legal scholars of our day, a man named Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz wrote a philosophy of law showing how modern law is rooted in the Ten Commandments. And he went back in his book before talking about the Ten Commandments, and he said, let's look at how the storyline of the scriptures builds up to the Ten Commandments. And he actually teaches that what God asked Abraham to do was unjust. It led Abraham to act immorally and in self-interest. And he essentially goes on to say that later on God fixed it when he did not allow murder. In his lesson, Dave Conant taught us to disagree with Alan Dershowitz and his theory of what was happening here in Genesis. But Dave urged us to respond with horror. He said, if you read Genesis 22 and you don't respond with horror or shock at what God's asking Abraham to do, you've gotten way too familiar with Scripture. When you see God ask Abraham, sacrifice your son to me, you should react, God, what are you doing? And then you should think about it. And the first thing you should think is, God owns Isaac. Abraham knows that God owns Isaac. God is responsible for every breath Isaac takes. Abraham knows that God gave him and Sarah Isaac. He was a miracle-born son. And he knows that Isaac is God's, and the Creator can do with his creation what he wills. Dave, in that lesson, taught us, God has the right to take the life he gives. He's absolutely right. God alone can take life because God alone can give it. God can take the life of Job's 10 children in a tragic storm. God can take the life of David's baby boy. God can take the life of Ezekiel's wife so that Ezekiel lives as a widow the rest of his days. God has the authority to take life because he alone has the authority to give it. God owns Isaac. The next thing you need to think as you're thinking through the horrors of what God's asking is that God's going to fulfill his promise regarding Isaac. He owns Isaac, and he's going to fulfill his promise. Not only had God given Isaac through a miraculous birth, but God had promised to do incredible things through Isaac's children. And I think Abraham probably reasoned, if God made good on the first one, I have no clue how, but he's going to make good on the rest. At this point, it seems that Abraham realized that he was going to kill his son, and Abraham believed that God was going to raise him again. You see in verse 5, chapter 22, verse 5, he said, both I and the boy are going to return back here after we go worship on that mountain. It seems that Abraham reasoned, I'm going to kill him, and God's going to raise him to life, because God's got plans for this boy. In fact, that's exactly what the writer to the Hebrews says. Hebrews 11, 19. Abraham considered that God was even able to raise him from the dead. Abraham knew that God had plans for this boy. And he said, I think God's going to raise him from the dead. Third, God is using this episode with Isaac to teach the world about sacrifice. So if you're thinking through it, you think first, God owns Isaac. You think second, God's got big plans for Isaac. You think third, God's teaching the world through this episode with Isaac. What is he teaching? Well, in one sense, what God was asking Abraham to do is something that Abraham was actually very familiar with because of the surrounding peoples in this region. Many of the peoples in this region did the horrific evil of offering child sacrifice to the hungry, violent gods. So when God says, offer your son, in one sense, Abraham at least is familiar with the practice. You wonder if in Abraham's idolatrous past, there had ever been this even in his family. We don't know. Many of the nations practiced child sacrifice. It's awful. You can still see horrific etchings of it from this period in various museums. But God uses this incident to powerfully tell Abraham, and then all of Israel after him, for every generation after him, God actually is saying by this incident, I never want you to sacrifice your children to me. He is stating it in the most dramatic way, like using a highlighter over and over and over. You do not sacrifice your children to me. God is actually setting the pattern for what's going to come about in a few hundred years when he's going to say, this is how you offer animal sacrifices to me. The only right sacrifice will involve animal substitutes in God's original worship scheme that's foreshadowing Jesus. So God uses this dramatic incident to actually teach people that they should not sacrifice their children. So the first thing you need to do is you need to react with horror, and then you need to think about it. God owns Isaac. God's got plans for Isaac. And God's using Isaac to teach dramatically the opposite of what we originally fear. He's not teaching that we have to sacrifice our children to God. Secondly, we need to react with wonder and then commit our lives to Jesus. If you haven't already, this is where I'm going in point number two. You need to commit your life to Jesus. You need to be a follower of Jesus. Why? Because this account in Genesis 22 was penned around 1,500 years before Jesus. It was at least 1,500 years before Jesus came. This chapter that we just read was penned. Think about this. 1,500 years before Jesus comes, this account is penned. You say, why is that significant? Well, think about it. Abraham does not withhold his one and only son. His son Isaac, like an obedient servant, carries the wood on his back up the hill of Jerusalem. Mount Moriah is in Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles 3:1 says it's where the temple was built, Solomon's temple. And God, there on the mountain in Jerusalem, provides the sacrifice. Let me go through this again. Abraham does not withhold his one and only son. Instead, Isaac, like an obedient servant, carries wood on his back up the hill in Jerusalem. And there, on the mountain in Jerusalem, God provides the sacrifice. You can't make this stuff up. That's written 1,500 years at least. The account is actually happening much longer before than that, about 2,000 years. It's written down in Moses' day, 1,500 years before Jesus comes, and what happens in Jerusalem? Romans 8:32. God does not withhold his one and only son. Instead, God sent his only begotten son into the world, John 3:16. It's Jesus. As the Father's obedient servant, Jesus carries, at least for a time, the wood of the cross on his back up the hill of the same city. You see, God was no hypocrite. He was no lazy commander. Abraham, you do this. I don't want to get my hands dirty. You take care of it. No. When God asked Abraham to offer his one and only son as a sacrifice, he wasn't asking Abraham to do something he wouldn't himself do. In fact, he stopped Abraham before killing his one and only son. When it came to God's one and only son, God allowed him to endure the horrific death of crucifixion. Why? Because, get it. Jesus of Nazareth was Abraham's offspring, through whom all peoples on earth would be blessed if they follow him, blessed with forgiveness of sins, blessed with resurrection life, blessed with life forever in the kingdom under Jesus' peaceful rule. Jesus is the blessing for the world, and he follows the pattern of the sacrifice. And you and I just need to sit back at this point and let the chills go up and down our back. You can't make this stuff up. Jesus is perfectly following the pattern. The way God has chosen to bring an end to sin and death on this planet was to send his one and only son in love and in amazing grace so that he would die on the cross and rise again so that forgiveness of sins could be announced to anyone who will commit themselves to Jesus. It is the only way you can be saved. It's the only way you can be forgiven. You must commit your life to Jesus, the crucified, risen, and returning King to reign on this planet. He is the one in whom blessing is found. There is no other way to have a relationship with God than through committing your life to Jesus. So you should react with wonder when you read Genesis 22, knowing what happened 1,500 years later when Jesus ascended the hill called Calvary, or Golgotha, the place of the skull, and was crucified there, that place where the Father did not withhold his one and only son from a sinner like you. You should stand in awe, and you should commit your life to follow King Jesus. Final truth, final reaction. React with humility. Trust and obey God daily. The last way we need to react to this passage is to say, God, make me someone who trusts you and obeys you like Abraham. Von Roberts says, we must trust in the gospel promises even when we have no clue what God is doing in our lives. We've got to follow Abraham in this regard. Believer, do you know that God is going to repeatedly put your faith to the test? He's going to do regularly what he did here with Abraham. And God's design when he puts our faith to the test is always to grow us, always to refine us, always to put, as it were, gold into fire so that it comes out refined and purer and more to his praise and glory. He's going to test us like he tested Abraham. If you commit your life to Jesus, you're going to get tested. It might be epic life tests. Some of you have been through this. You committed to follow Jesus, and your spouse said, "I'm done with you. You used to be fun. What happened?" And it ended up in a divorce. You've been put through the test. Others of you in here may have cost you your inheritance. I don't know. This is what often happens when Muslims convert. They're disinherited from the family. Some of you lose the respect of your adult children. "Mom, you're following Jesus? You're one of those people? Have you lost your marbles? What in the world?" Following Jesus might involve really hard trials. It's not that following Jesus actually caused the trials, it's just accompanied with them. It's what the Taylors are experiencing. They're following Jesus, and God's causing them right now to go through floodwaters as they're wondering, is God going to take our son? They're being put to the test right now. That's where their faith's at. Some of you say, "I'm following Jesus, and there's nothing more I want in life than to be married. But God still has me single." These are life tests that accompany following Jesus. Now, I've just described some epic life tests, similar to the ones that are described here. But for most of us, our testing is much less epic. Like, I had big plans for this week, but my kid threw up last night and I didn't get any sleep. And I think I'm going to die. I don't know how I'm going to get through this week. That's like typically the test we're dealing with, right? Or maybe little things like business was going great until you just lost that customer. Or my life was fine until that friend called me and we had a row on the phone, and now it seems like my life's falling apart. God, why are you doing this to me? When you're put through a test in which something precious, something you love, is taken from you, and something happens to you that makes no sense and you don't understand, trust and obey. God's in control. He's got a plan. He's working it out. If your faith is tested in small ways or in big ways, you need to refocus on the promises. You need to come back here maybe to Genesis, to the basics, and you need to say, what in the world is God doing? Oh, he's bringing blessing to all peoples on earth through Jesus. He forgives people's sins through faith in Jesus, through life commitment to Jesus. God has promised that he's going to raise our bodies at the return of Jesus. And God is most certainly in control of fulfilling his plan, his promises, even when I'm unfaithful. You need to sink yourself back into these basic truths and say, I'm going to trust God today, and I'm going to obey God. No matter what test he's putting me through, it doesn't give me an allowance, a free card to disobey and live however I want and get as impatient and irritable. No. I'm going to trust God, and I'm going to obey him. I'm going to ask his Spirit to control me so that I live humbly gently, that I try to communicate something of Jesus' character in my relationships. When testing comes, like Abraham, you need to fear God. You need to respect him, reverence him, be humble before him. And that means trusting and obeying him, even when it costs you dearly. It means trusting and obeying him, even when it doesn't make sense.